Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We are dedicated to furthering understanding of the Great War and have around 50 branches worldwide. It is the 15th of April, 2025, and this is episode 353. On today's episode of the podcast, I'm joined by Steve Hammond, the editor and compiler of Quarter Bloke with the Westminsters at War, a remarkable book that offers a detailed look into the life of Edgar Percy Loveland, a soldier in the Queen's Westminster Rifles who served with that unit throughout the Great War. Through Edgar's diaries, letters and photographs, as well as Steve's extensive research, this work paints a deeply personal picture of the everyday realities of war in the QWR. Steve joined me from his home in Hertfordshire. Steve, welcome back to the Dispatches podcast for the second time. Could you just remind us by giving us a bit about your background and what drew you to Edgar Percy Loveland's story?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me back. Well, as you know, I'm a Hertfordshire lad, born and raised in Hemel Hempstead. Now live not far from Leverstock Green, which is where the Westminsters were billeted, as I told you before. And that started my interest in the Westminsters, particularly when I picked up a few postcards that were written by and sent by men of the Westminsters to their family in 1914. Edgar came into my life when I was contacted by an old collector pre-COVID. And he was saying he'd got quite a few bits of Westminster interest that I might want to buy off him. So I went down to Crystal Palace to see him, and I had to buy the lot just to get Edgar's log. And it was just so good, I simply had to buy it. And then COVID struck, and we all know what happened then. So I was furloughed from work, and I was looking at Edgar's stuff and looking at the stuff I've got, the research I've done, the photos I've got, and I just thought, I've got to do something with this, and now is a good time to do it. So that's how it started, mate.
And I must say, I have indeed myself purchased one of these books, and they're really interesting. Now, it's called Quarter Bloke because we'll probably come on to in a minute that Edgar was a quartermaster, but we'll wait until we get there. Now, the book gives a really intimate look at Edgar's life. Can you tell us about Edgar and what sort of person he was before the war, and what sort of things he got up to, and what was his life leading up to the outbreak of war in 1914?
Well, he was born in Eastbourne in 1895, and the 1911 census shows him in London with his parents and his sister. He'd moved up to Wood Green. As a young lad, he was well into the Scouts, and you get more of that later in his life as well, but he was a patrol leader at a young age in the 4th Wood Green Scouts, and he was a signal instructor as well, which helped him later in life as well, I would say, in the North London Scouts. By 16, he's working as a clerk in WD and HO Wills, tobacco manufacturers. And then 11 months before his 18th birthday, he joins the Queen's Westminsters. So he's obviously a very organised young man.
And so He joins the Queen's Westminsters, that's the 16th Battalion London Regiment, for those who may not be well versed in the joys of the London Regiment. And he does that in 1912. Why does he choose this particular formation? And tell us about his experiences in the QWR before the war.
Well, why he joined them, probably he's a clerk, and they were probably known as a battalion of clerks, part of the class sort of battalions in the London Regiment at the time. And he actually paid a princely sum of £1.05 for the privilege of joining them. But in his book, in his diary, he describes it as just simply a day of days. He was very proud to join the Westminsters. When he joined, his life became very busy because early regimental life included things like concerts at Buckingham Gate, their headquarters. Concerts would be like smoking concerts, which would be for men only. Cinderella dances where the women were involved. You had range shooting indoor downstairs at Buckingham Gate, and they'd have trips to Bisley for shooting. You had your church parades at Westminster Abbey, which was very close for the Westminsters, strong links there. Summer camps Edgar's first one, 1912 at Frith Hill. 1913, they went to Abergavenny, another busy camp. Also in 1913, they had a historical display at the Royal Hospital, Chelsea, where all the men of different companies dressed up in the uniforms that were worn by Westminster's from 1813 to 1913. That would have been a very colourful experience. And then his next summer camp in August 1914, 2nd of August, they went to Perham Down. And this is where he heard news of the outbreak of war. And he describes like the pandemonium there in his book, the excitement, the singing of like national anthems, French, British, it was all going on. So highly excited by the prospect of war.
Which, yes. I mean, again, capturing the mood of the time. So in your book, you blend Loveland's personal writings with a degree of historical context. How did his diary entries and letters provide a unique window into the experience of soldiers during the Great War?
Experience of soldiers. Well, Edgar confidently believed all their pre-war training as territorials gave them a great advantage when they arrived in France. And I think he believed it helped them convince the men of the regulars they were attached to the 6th Division to start with. And they ended up getting on really well with these men who had quite a lot of respect for them. So, you know, the so-called despised territorials actually did well for themselves early doors. But Edgar, he had great affection for his officers and the fellow men. And he was, you know, very complimentary in his praise of the officers and also the camaraderie built up between the men. There's one instance where he describes a young rifleman, Rifleman Hale, getting bad trench foot. And he's one of Edgar's old original B Company lads. And Edgar says he just massaged the lad's feet for him and then took on his guard duty. So they were always looking out for each other. They were then that kind of men. And also Edgar's letters, he's, you know, the letters he wrote home to his parents, he was always trying to convince the family that he was fine. There was nothing wrong with being out there. Moaned about the weather a bit, but he was just trying to stop them worrying. So that's the kind of man he was.
Now, he was obviously, he was a junior clerk, as you've mentioned, before the war, and then he becomes a quartermaster in the Queen's Westminster's. How did this transformation from civilian life to military service shape his character and outlook? And I wonder whether you could just tell us a bit about what a quartermaster did.
Well, Edgar was in charge of all the stores, supplies, arranging breakfast, meals, getting food to the men. And, you know, this was started at, even at Leverstock Green, just arranging stuff. And quite often they'd get back from a day out and think there'd be time to go for a little lie down and nap. And no, not for Edgar. He'd have to get like stuff ready for the next meal. So it was quite a tough job. It was a work that needed doing and he did it very well. He seemed to be a well-organised man in civilian life, and his dedication to the scouts as a young lad, I think, stood him in good stead. It helped him. I think this helped him with his promotion through the ranks as well, coming up to become a CQMS, which is what he ended up at. And it shows in how thorough his diary and his log is. And post-war even, he's very dedicated to the Old Contemptibles Association and the Retired Members Association of the regiment as well. So he did used to write for both of them and obviously signed off as quarter bloke. You see that in some of the old OCA, Old Contemptible Association magazines that come out signed quarter bloke, and we know exactly who he is now.
Which is useful because it's a source I have to go through in the near future. Now, the Queen's Westminster Rifles, they saw pretty heavy action during the Great War. I wonder whether you could give us a broad outline of what they did from 1914 up to 1916 and how Edgar's experiences in battles like Gommancourt, at which my grandfather was involved, shaped his view of war and his comrades.
Well, early doors, he was obviously involved in the Christmas Truce. He writes a lot about the Christmas Truce. Hoop Line, that was one of Edgar's favourite places, very close between the Germans and the British there. They leave Hoop Line and go to Ypres. They're on the salient until they become part of the 56th Div, which involves moving down for training for the Battle of the Somme. And when it actually came to the Battle of the Somme, Edgar, being CQMS, was left out of the battle at Gommancourt. But he sort of wrote he wrote a nice piece actually on the aftermath, which is in the book, which you'll be able to read. But he sort of writes with great sorrow of the losses, but also with great pride with what they achieved that day. So, he sort of would be almost relieved if a man got a blighty wound and got sent home. He'd be quite happy for him. But then it could also turn to sorrow. And I'm just going to read a bit about a lad called William Riddon. And he was one of Edgar's early company men. And he says simply, during the night, operations having been completed, the battalion was relieved and moved back to the canal bank as brigade reserve. On the way back, the RSM, who was accompanying our platoon out, was commiserating with poor old A Company on what had been a rotten time they had had and how they had caught it. When, as the platoon had just passed the Petite Crossroads and was proceeding along the Saint-Jean Road, a bullet hit the road, ricocheted, and hit Will Riddon in the knee. We patched him up and left him in the charge of two stretcher bearers of the Tigers who were passing at the time. We thought he had got a real blighty one, but were astonished and sadly disillusioned when, sometime later on, we learned that he had died from the wound. A local lad, he was one of my first recruits, and I felt his loss very much indeed. He was one of the first of our local contingent to go. It was a sad business losing one's pals one by one, and though we got to a certain extent callous over these matters, each succeeding one seemed to make a bigger wrench. And he also goes on, I was saying about the officers and how much they love the officers, but if I could just read another little bit where he describes losing one of their officers. On the 2nd of October 1915, Edgar wrote, "The company sustained one of its greatest losses. The skipper, our beloved Dickie, Raymond Scott Dickinson, was killed by a whiz bang. He was piloting a couple of artillery officers round the front line when one lone shell hit the roof of a dugout right alongside him and killed him instantaneously. We rushed into the traverse. He lay there, a half-smoked cigarette still between his fingers and a smile on his face. A surge of hate welled up in our hearts, cursed the Hun good and proper, and vowed a terrible vengeance given half a chance. His happy and cheery character, fearlessness, and his power of leadership had made him implicitly trusted, as well as beloved by his seniors and adored by the company." That's some praise for an officer.
And so something I realised I should have put in the questions is what exactly happened to Edgar after the Battle of the Somme and to the end of the war?
Well, he simply remains as the CQMS. He doesn't write of being involved in any battles. He writes mainly of seeing the men coming out of the battles, supporting men. And it sort of tails off in that respect, really, as far as Edgar's concerned.
But as far as we know, he actually served with the unit right to the end of the war.
Oh, he does. He goes right through. Yeah, I'll touch on that a bit later, in a later question, Tom.
No problems. But I'm coming on to my next one. So, what happened to Loveland and the Queen's Westminster Rifles after the war? How did Edgar's post-war life compare to his wartime experiences?
Well, post-armistice, Edgar, like some of the others that were left in the Cadre that was left behind, thought he was going to go to Germany. But another little reading for you, Tom. He wrote, after the armistice, the battalion was warned it was to take part in the March to the Rhine, commencing on November the 17th. Disappointment followed, however, when this was cancelled and the battalion was ordered to spend the rest of the winter in Belgium. They remained in Athies until November the 26th, then on to Bougny, and finally arrived at Genlis near Mons on the 29th. Here they remained until March the 23rd, 1919. And then he goes on to say, happier times followed with rugby, football, dancing, concerts, and lectures arranged. A party was held to celebrate Christmas, arranged jointly by Major H.F. Grizzell, MC, Captain F.E. Whitby, MC and Bar, the mayor, and local residents. Every local child was invited and all received a present from Santa. The men were treated to a grand whist drive on December the 27th, courtesy of Major Grizzell. So a totally different Christmas to the one he experienced in 1914. But they returned to London actually on June the 2nd, 1919. And Edgar actually signed on for 3 more years in the regiment then. But he married his wife Muriel in 1921, and he obviously found that didn't give him the time he wanted to devote to the regiment. So he applied for a discharge and he offered to buy his way out. And I think the regiment thought so highly of him, his discharge was granted, and the fee to pay was nil. So that was how his war ended.
You spent a great deal of time compiling and editing this book. What was the most surprising or unexpected discovery you made when you were looking at Edgar's war service?
There's one surprise in the book for me, and it's another little short bit to read, was again about Leverstock Green. I didn't realise half of this stuff went on just down the road from where I live. And Edgar wrote about that. He says, "One operation which stands out most vividly among the many night ops in which we indulged concerned a night attack on the village. B Company scouts advancing cautiously through the gloom discovered two machine gun posts on the outskirts of the village. Word was passed back, and numbers 3 and 4 sections advanced to deal with them. Approaching cautiously to within reasonable distance, Dickie, our old friend Lieutenant R.S. Dickinson, our section commander, drew his sword and gave the order to charge. Down the village street we shot, Dickie waving his sword and uttering unearthly yells, we doing our best to assist him in the general din and turmoil of the moment. Talk about a hectic rush, and the next half hour was spent in trying to convince the machine gunners that they had been completely wiped out, and vice versa." All that going on in our local village.
And my final question, Stevie, is where can people find out more about Loveland's story and your work on the Queen's Westminster's Rifles? I suppose really what I'm saying is where can people buy the book?
Where can they buy the book? Well, I'm on Facebook, just simply as Steve Hammond, and I'm also on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Steve Hammond, at Wilf Steve on there. If anyone just does a search for Queen's Westminster Rifles on there, you'll find me, no doubt, and lots of stuff, info I put on there. There's plenty there to be found. And I can be contacted through those or simply my email, which is hammond.steve@btopenworld.com. And there's more importantly, Tom, there's the upcoming London Pride project, which you know too well. There's I've done a chapter for that, and that contains more about Edgar later in life, because that's more about the men after the war, my chapter, and it's called The Peculiar Bond, and it's about the bond between the men and how it lasts not only through the war but after the war. So retired member of associations and the like.
Yes, and that at our time of recording is moving on slowly, and I'm currently just compiling volume one, and obviously your chapter will be in volume two. But the
So,
probably the most important thing you haven't mentioned is that the book Waterboke is not available from shops, so it has to be ordered directly from yourself.
from me, yep. It was a small private publication, just something I dreamed of doing. So I only did 200 copies, selling fast, 100, over 100 gone already, which I'm really, really pleased about. So if anyone would like one, get in there quickly.
Please do. It's well worth it. Steve, on that bombshell, I'm going to say thank you very much for your time. You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Russman and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS 2195. Until next time.